Good evening. This is Around Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay. On tonight's program, Nancy Rosenthal talks about a very special Chinese exhibition at the Taft Museum. You'll hear details of an Amish cookbook and another book focusing on bed and breakfasts in Kentucky. There's a production of Our Town at the Covedale, and a couple of very talented students drop by to chat about their latest CD and a play at SCPA. Plus music from the Blues and Boogie Piano Summit on Around Cincinnati. Frank Johnson is joined by two talented and very busy SCPA students.
A couple of our favorite local young musicians are back in, and they have a new CD out, too, by the way. We'll talk about that and find out what they're up to. Rosie Carson is a phenomenal violin player and singer, and she does a lot of music, mostly folk music, you know, Celtic folk music. And her partner in music making is Lucas Wozniak, who's just an incredible harp player. Now, we're not talking about the full, you know, big Harpo Marx kind of harp, but a smaller, more concise Celtic harp, which sounds absolutely gorgeous. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Frank.
Now, let's talk about this new CD. This is a whole new game for you both. I mean, you've been playing together for many years now, and this is a new CD featuring just the two of you. It's called A Matter of Time. So who wants to be the first to tell us about it?
Yeah, this is our first CD, as you said. I made a CD when I was 12, but this is the first reel for sale. Hopefully we're getting it out there to a lot of people.
And this is your first collaboration on CD,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, there's a lot of traditional music and some specific songs that are just very well-known, you know, more recent music, too, in the folk music scene.
Yeah, well, we've got everything from, you know, an old Scottish tune dating back to who knows when to Black Money River by Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead.
Now, Lucas, there's a Grateful Dead song on here with harp. That's something you don't hear every day.
No, and that's really entirely of our own creation. As you said, you don't hear that every day. We really had to make up the whole concept of that from scratch, but I think it turned out pretty well.
When you were choosing music, we mentioned a lot of it is traditional stuff. I mean, and there's so much out there to choose from. How do you pick out a specific song?
I think it depends partly on whether or not it really sounds good to both of us, whether we really like the music. And then I guess the second thing we really consider is the creative touches that we personally can add to it to really make it our own.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific songs. And one's called The Humors of Whiskey, a traditional tune. So how did that one get chosen?
Well, it is a very popular traditional tune, especially in Irish music sessions, that I guess we learned early on when we were beginning sessions ourselves, and we felt that we could do some nice ornamentation with it, and I felt good about my bass line, and it paired with another tune of ours that's a big favorite, Flying to the Flaw, which it's in the set with, so.
And you mentioned the Jerry Garcia tune, Rosie. You mentioned Black Money River. How did you mean that? Again, so many Grateful Dead songs to choose from. Why that one?
Well, actually, we heard that specific song from Watterson Carthy group, which was Norma Watterson, Martin Carthy, and Eliza Carthy. And they did a version of it, and they didn't actually know who had written it until someone came up to them and said, oh, I love that Grateful Dead song you did, Black Money River. So that's kind of where we learned it. But then we listened to the original version by Jerry Garcia, and we liked that too. So that's what had some influence on it as well.
So the CD is called A Matter of Time. And the very last song, let's just get right to that. That's one of the songs that both of you have performed. I've seen you perform it many times. It's a Sandy Denny tune called Who Knows Where the Time Goes. And can you tell us about that one?
Well, that's probably my favorite song of all time. The lyrics lend to our style of playing and just where we are in life. And
it's a very thought and emotion-provoking song, really. I think everyone can relate to watching time pass and sort of feel that sensation of, oh, who knows where yesterday actually went. But it was nice when it was going on.
Now, that's kind of a very melancholy song to wrap up the CD. What's your favorite real good dance tune on here?
I love the first track. I love Lucas.
As do I, yeah.
Lucas starts that one off. That's the Flying to the Flaw track, and it's just an amazing piece of music.
Now, the second song is called The Wolf Trap, and that's an original, something that you collaborated on a composition. Now, most of the songs that you two do together, that you perform, are mostly old folk tunes and covers, but this is something new, you know, a collaboration.
Yeah, it was actually our first and, to date, but not forever, only composition, and it was entirely a collaborative effort, which is why there are some parts of it that sound like a harp tune and other parts that sound like a fiddle tune. It combines for a nice little variation in melody that's, I think, very unique.
Now, also, I want to mention, too, that coming up on Saturday the 15th is a big celebration party, really, a CD release party of A Matter of Time. This will be at Molly Malone's over in Covington, and that's Saturday night, so it works out for you guys because, you know, you don't have to wake up early the next day and go to school.
Saturday night, yeah.
So, see, we have to mention this. You guys are still in high school. I mean, you know, I mean, for all the music you're making and all the travels you've done, the concerts you've performed, you're still real, just regular high school kids.
That we are.
Which brings us to another project that you're both working on. It's a performance of Cats coming up. So you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really, really excited to be doing that. It's SCPA's adapted version of Andrew Lloyd Webber's famous Broadway show, directed by Gina Kleesaddle, who's done the major musical at SCPA for, I believe, the past 9 years, and she's really done some fabulous work with the students, and I'm proud to say that I am Miss Kleesaddle's stage manager for the Cats production.
So you're actually not going to be on stage for this?
No, I will be in the wings making sure the lights go up, the curtain goes down, the cues start on time. That will be me.
So you're in charge?
After the director.
Okay,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you're running things.
I am.
Okay, so that means you tell Rosie what to do then, right?
Whether or not she takes that easily and with grace is up for debate, but yes, I do.
And Rosie, you're actually going to be one of the cats.
Yeah, that's a new thing. Never crawled around in spandex on stage, but it should be really fun, though. I'm really excited about it.
So this is the whole makeup and everything, huh?
Yeah, it's the whole shebang. Everyone will be looking like cats, hopefully. That's
now,
the goal.
How many cats will there be on stage?
42.
Wow, that's a lot of kids. Mm-hmm. So do you do any solos or anything like that?
Well, I have a duet song with another character, and we sing about the bad guy, kind of a
McCavity.
His name is McCavity.
And what are the dates of Cats? Well, I should ask, too, where is it going to be performed, and what are the dates for it?
Cats will be at the Aronoff in the PNG Theater, the big theater.
We're very happy about that, getting it back for the second year in a row. It's a great space to work in.
And that will be November 6th through 9th.
So that's going to be a pretty good time then.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be so much fun.
But you guys are working just so hard for that. I mean, we're talking about, what, a month's worth of preparation for that or even longer? 2 months.
2 months, yeah. And, which is actually a short amount of time.
Oh, very short.
Shorter than
yeah.
we usually have.
The rehearsal process has been very intense because we have had a shorter time for this musical than any to date, I believe. I have to be at every rehearsal, so that's after school, usually from 4 o'clock to 6 or 6:30, 5 days a week, and Rosie has to be at most rehearsals, and both of us are usually there on Saturday from about 1 to 4.
Now, how do you keep all this straight? Because you're also still doing just the two of you, the music work that you guys do, and then you're also working on the stage production on Cats. How do you keep things straight?
Well, it's good that we're both in it because then we're basically going the same time. So
right. We
can either come home and practice or go to rehearsal together after practicing for a while. So
it takes some creative scheduling. It is fortunate that we do have a similar schedule for this, but we also, you know, we have other things. Rosie sings with the chorale, the school chorus. I also work with the school's drama ensemble. So we both have very packed schedules, but we manage.
So we're talking with Lucas Wozniak and Rosie Carson, who, you know, you guys don't have any time to yourselves, it sounds like. They're just working hard in high school, working on a new production of Cats, a CD coming out called A Matter of Time with just the two of them. It's Rosie doing the singing and violin, and Lucas playing the flute. I should mention, too, that we'll be doing a show coming up around Christmas, Around Cincinnati Christmas Special. It'll be December 21st, and the two of you will be performing.
Yep.
Now, did you pick out a specific Christmas song for that?
We did. We chose I Saw Three Ships, which is an old English carol, which sort of touches upon our style of music. Plus, it's written in a time similar to jig rhythm. So
being us, we had to throw a jig of our own there.
Right in the middle. Very subtle.
And again, congratulations on the new CD, A Matter of Time, and there'll be the party, the CD release party coming up on November 15th, a Saturday night, over in Covington at Molly Malone. Should be a real good time, and people can come in and watch you guys play. I'd like to say thanks to Steve Carson, who is the producer of the CD. Thank you very much for bringing Rosie and Lucas down to the studio. And I'd like to say thank you to you guys again for just giving us so much music over the years and just being really sensational young people, sensational musicians, and continued success.
Thank you so much for having us.
We'll be hearing from you again in the future, I'm sure.
Definitely. Certainly hope so.
For Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson.
WVXU is supported by Cincinnati Magazine. Cincinnati Magazine, whose monthly Dine section covers local restaurants with reviews of new spots and long-standing favorites. Over 900 restaurant listings arranged by cuisine, neighborhood, and region. Available at cincinnatimagazine.com.
David Delegator gets the details of a Convy Table cookbook chronicling Amish life.
We're speaking today with Kevin Williams, who's the editor and co-author of a new book that has cultural and regional significance here, The Amish Cook at Home, Simple Pleasures of Food, Family, and Faith. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get involved in writing a book about Amish cooking, and what's your involvement in Amish culture originally?
I have been editor of the Amish Cook column for 18 years, half my life. And when I was 18 years old, I was a journalism student, and I just sort of stumbled into the Amish cook randomly. I was sort of driving through rural Indiana and needed directions out, and I pulled into this Amish lady's driveway, and we just sort of clicked, connected, and I, being 18, I thought, wouldn't it be neat to read about this way of life every week in a newspaper column? This Amish lady agreed to do it. And we just started off on that path. I started syndicating this column. She wrote it, and it became popular.
It was a serendipitous moment, I think.
It was. It changed my life.
And the driveway down which you went, whose home was that?
That was the driveway of Elizabeth Koblentz. She was, at the time, a 56-year-old Amish woman. I was an 18-year-old college student. And we just crafted this partnership where she would write the column each week, and I would attempt to sell it to newspapers. She wrote the column for 11 years, during which time the column grew and we had it in about 100 newspapers. She suddenly passed away in 2002, and her daughter Levina took over the column, and Levina writes it today.
So there was a book that preceded this one on Amish cooking that you did, yes?
It was a book that I wrote with Elizabeth. It's sort of similar to the book that we have out now in that it captures more than just recipes. It's more than just a cookbook. It sort of told the story of a typical Amish family.
What was the name of that book?
That was The Amish Cook Recollections and Recipes. I think the biggest difference between that book and this book is that Elizabeth was sort of in the twilight of her life at that time. Her children were grown and moved out. I think our new book captures an energy that you find in a young Amish family more than her mother, who was older at the time.
This book you co-wrote with Levina Eicher. That's her daughter, Elizabeth's daughter. Is
yes.
That right? Is their perspective on cooking and Amish culture in general radically different from one another, or are they pretty similar?
I think they were pretty similar. Change comes very slowly to the Amish, and values are passed on from generation to generation. So I think they had a very similar outlook.
Now, one of the things I really liked about this book, although the recipes tended to be simple, I think it's a reflection of, you know, the Amish culture in general. But this book is set up so that recipes are done seasonally. The book is divided into the four seasons. And the recipes in the chapters are indicative of the food that's grown or harvested at that time in that season.
The Amish live their lives very much tied to the seasons and the calendar, probably more so than you and I shut out the seasons with our air conditioning and heat and things like that. So, yes, the recipes are divided into seasons. Right now it's autumn, and on Amish farms, most of them you'll find apples very much in use and pumpkin, and the book sort of takes that seasonal theme.
As far as the other aspect of the book I found really interesting is that both you and Levina Eicher wrote side-by-side reflections on Amish culture and on the recipes themselves. Your perspective is a little different coming from being outside the Amish world, but at the same time, inside, you can be a fairly objective observer.
Yeah, you asked how her mother and Levina were different, and there aren't a lot of differences, but if you ask how Levina and I are different, there are a lot of differences. I mean, my life is controlled by Google and text messages on my phone and email, and Levina, you know, I've tried to explain websites to her and text messaging and things like that, and that's, it's just a very different world. But we find a way to make our two existences work together.
The sect of Amish that Levina is doesn't exclude her from participating in this world at all, does it?
No. I mean, it's a delicate balance, because that's why you're talking to me today instead of Levina. She wouldn't be allowed to and isn't allowed to put herself out there too much. Writing the column is limited to handwriting this letter each week, but if she were to appear on the radio with you or to go on to Good Morning America and do a cooking segment, that would absolutely cross the line, and she would probably feel the ramifications from her church.
Where is the column syndicated? Is it mostly in this part of the country or all over?
It's in about 120 newspapers, and most of them are in the Midwest, but one of our larger newspapers that carries it is the Tacoma, Washington newspaper. There are a handful of newspapers in Florida that carry it. So it's really all over the place, but generally from Kansas to Pennsylvania.
I read in the book that there's an Amish community near Sarasota.
There is. It's a lot of fun to visit there, too, because instead of buggies, you see the Amish people riding on three-wheeled tricycles as their mode of transportation. Amish people will visit the nearby beach, and they'll be wearing their long dresses and, you know, wading into the water. And it's a much more laid-back atmosphere there than the Midwestern Amish communities.
The cooking itself, the recipes in the book, they call back to certainly to an earlier day in American history. The Amish culture seems to preserve the simplicity of cooking, and you know, it's very direct, simple, the recipes, not highly spiced, but healthy.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of processed foods in Amish diets. They're still very much dominated by garden foods, desserts from scratch. It's timely what you bring up, because the economic tough times that this country is experiencing, the Amish are still pretty insulated from it. You know, most of the recipes, the ingredients are already in their pantry, would already be in your pantry or mine. They're very simple, and that comes from their desire to be self-sufficient.
The essays in the book about Amish culture, just fascinating. I learned a lot by reading it. I mean, things from buggy construction to the way that Amish celebrate various holidays and seasons. And it's a great book. So you're going to be traveling with Levina, and are you coming back here to Cincinnati?
Yeah, we are going to be at Joseph Beth on November 8th to do a book signing. And it's very different for her to be out making a public appearance like that, but kind of promised our publisher we'd do a couple. But it's very much out of her element to come and meet a crowd of people and sign her books.
Again, the date at Joseph Beth?
We'll be there on Saturday, November the 8th at 1 o'clock.
We've been talking today with Kevin Williams, co-author of The Amish Cook at Home, Simple Pleasures of Food, Family, and Faith. Thanks so much for being with us today, Kevin.
Thank you.
For Around Cincinnati, I'm David Delegater.
Support comes from Willow Creative Group, for 20 years helping the Cincinnati community and its clients flourish through transformative ideas. In celebration of this milestone, Willow continues to facilitate growth by donating 20 trees to be planted on 3rd Street between Broadway and Main. Learn how you can support growth in the greater Cincinnati community at willowcreativegroup.com.
Brush Clay Wood is an exhibition at the Taft Museum of Art which traces the development of Chinese art. Jane Durrell recently sat down with Nancy Rosenthal, one of the owners of this valuable collection.
Nancy, so nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're going to talk about the collection of Chinese art that you and your husband have gathered and that we can all see selections of in an exhibition that will be opening next week at the Taft Museum of Art. When did you start collecting Chinese art and what led you into it?
Well, we had an exceptional first trip to China in 1987. We went with the Smithsonian Museum. It was a trip called the Arts of China, and they took us to places where they first found the kaolin, the clay that they make the ceramics from. It was just seeing a lot of fascinating things. We actually didn't see paintings at that time, but lots of things from the tomb.
The title of the show is unusual. Instead of calling it Chinese art or something of that sort, it's called Brush, Clay, Wood. Tell us what's meant by that.
Well, because I think the show contains our collection, which is a little bit varied. It's not, you know, not everything is paintings. So that the brush really does signify the paintings. The clay signifies the things made of clay, the ceramics. And the wood signifies the furniture. We have a lovely collection of Ming furniture.
Well, one of the things that interests me about your collection is the vast sweep of it. The exhibition will include Neolithic pottery, Ming Dynasty furniture, contemporary paintings. Do these varied objects relate to one another in any way?
I think through the evolving Chinese culture, you know, it's such an ancient culture, and we just found the old things very fascinating. And, it comes all the way through to the contemporary. As for the furniture you live with and you start to look, I think you can live with it that is so beautiful, and this furniture is, we really love it.
So you sit in it and use it?
We sit in it, in the dining room, pieces like our buffet, little chests. Not everything we use, but most everything we use. So it's very lovely.
You and your husband travel periodically in China.
Right.
Have you seen changes in the society there?
Oh, it's enormous. We're very fortunate to have experienced. When the first time we went, the people were wearing the Mao jackets, and they were riding bicycles. And today, they're very dressed in the latest fashion. They're driving cars. In fact, I wouldn't want to drive in China. They're driving very fast. And they've caught up amazingly fast. It's just been a neat experience they've had the opportunity to witness.
Now, I understand that you've met some of the contemporary painters whose work you own. Surely that's an interesting thing.
It has been wonderful. Our last trip, last October, we got to visit an artist that was one of the first paintings we've owned over 20 years ago. And he knew that his painting won a contest and went to the United States. And he's still a fairly young man. He's a professor at the Sichuan Art Academy, and it was just really magic to meet him.
Do these people speak English, or do you have to talk through an interpreter?
Some of them do speak English. I think they're trying very hard. For them, English is the language to learn, and they teach it in their schools. They start in the elementary schools teaching English, so that a lot of them speak English. I wish I could speak Chinese.
Speaking Chinese sounds so difficult.
I'm not a linguist. It sounds very impossible to me.
Do you think that Chinese art will be changing direction in meaningful ways with China so increasingly part of the global world?
Probably. You can buy in the painting area, you know, some of the things you wouldn't be able to tell it that it came from China, other than the people, if they're, you know, if it's more of a realistic painting, the people are usually Chinese, but there's some things that are kind of abstracted and it could be almost made by any people anywhere.
When you go back to China, do you go back to the same places or have you traveled a good deal within the country?
We've traveled a good deal within the country. It's been, we're very fortunate. But I think if you're looking for art, there are some art centers that you like to go to. I mean, be it Beijing, you know, in Shanghai, the big cities. But even if you go to Hangzhou or out to out to the Sichuan area, there's so many people in this country. I'd never heard of Qingchong, and yet there's like 32 million people there until we went there, and an amazing art academy. So,
do you travel by train when you're there?
The first years we did train and bus, but now they have planes like we do. And we do try to travel by plane, unless, you know, the area is not too far apart. Then we will rent a car and have somebody else drive it and go by car.
The works in the Taft exhibition are usually in your own home. Do you feel as though something's missing now that they're temporarily gone?
We do. We can go down to the Taft and see them, but I think we're going to do some painting. It's a good time to paint those walls now that they're blank. And we certainly won't be doing much entertaining down during this period.
And you'll be welcoming them home. What direction do you expect the collection to take as you add to it?
Some of the things have had some difficulties. The ceramics, there's a certain kind of thing to be wary of. The archaeologists are very much discouraging any more digging, although I sometimes think that things are being saved when they get them out of the tombs before they destroy them, building all the buildings they're building and highways they're building and all that sort of thing. But ceramics are being difficult. The furniture is almost gone because the furniture we're collecting was from about the 1600 period, and there's not a lot left. So for us, the future will be paintings, I think.
When you say there's not a lot left of the furniture, has most of it gone out of the country or are the Chinese themselves collecting?
You know, being from the 1600s, I think any furniture from that period, a lot of it would be gone, destroyed, whatever. A lot was destroyed during the Cultural Revolution in China by the government themselves and the people in charge. I know one of our pieces was painted black to kind of disguise it when the dealer told us when he found it. There's just not a lot more good Ming furniture out there. There's later furniture, and they try to duplicate some of these things, but there's only certain kind of woods, and the joinery and the craftsmen that are doing it are not there anymore.
So you were fortunate to start when you did.
Yeah, we were very fortunate.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Nancy.
Thank you.
For more information on brush, clay, wood, see wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, this is Jane Durrell.
Support comes from St. Peter and James Cathedral. The next Great Music in a Great Space concert brings the Cincinnati debut performance of the Estonian Philharmonic Chamber Choir and the Tallinn Chamber Orchestra, Tuesday, November 11th, 7:30 p.m. Information from the Cathedral box office at 421-2222 or online at stpeterandjamescathedral.org.
Jim Stump is joined tonight by two actors who have been cast in a play well known to theatergoers.
Perhaps the most iconic American play of the early 20th century is Our Town, which takes place in Grover's Corner in New Hampshire in the early part of the 20th century. And it is the current production at the Covedale Center for Performing Arts. And joining me this evening are Angela Alexander Nally, who plays Mrs. Gibbs. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you, Jim.
And David Ratke, who plays Simon Stimson. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Now, when performing a show that is perhaps the most standardized classic of American theater, what sorts of things did you anticipate when you went into production that you found were different when you actually started working on the show?
Well, I found that as an actor, I mean, Our Town has always been one of my favorite shows of all time. I mean, it's 80 years old, but if you read it today, it really feels very contemporary. It has really stood up to the test of time. As an actor, I know when I went in to play Simon that we've really found a lot of the comic elements of the show that neither of us knew were there before. So as an actor, it's been really kind of fun to sort of take this show that in my mind has always been a very serious show and find the comedic elements that we've located in it.
Of course, now it revolves around those two families in Grover's Corner, and you are the matriarch of the Gibbs family.
Yes, I am.
And your son is...
My son is George.
And he is essentially growing into a relationship with Emily. Eventually, they marry.
And
life continues on despite certain tragedies. I won't spoil it for everyone who hasn't seen it, which is probably about three people in Cincinnati. But the day-to-day things, are you finding that you are enjoying recreating sort of day-to-day, or do you find it something that you have to kind of... Day-to-day now is so different from day-to-day then.
It absolutely is day-to-day now different than then. I had to actually write a list of things that I need to do, and in the order that they come, I have to light the fire so I can make the coffee, but I have to grind the beans before I can make the coffee. And then I have to go to the pump to pump the water so I could put the water into the pot and so on and so forth. So it's a lot of thinking, and although you're just saying the lines, you're really not just saying the lines. It's a lot of action.
And that brings up a very important point. Traditionally, the play is done very presentationally. You have the stage manager who acts as sort of the narrator and continuity person. And usually it's done on a very bare stage with only a few set pieces, the things that are absolutely necessary, chairs and tables and things like that. A lot of it is pantomimed. Is this so in your production?
It absolutely is, yes.
And have you practiced on real old hand-ground coffee grinders and pumps and such?
Unfortunately, no. We've had to go off of internet and see how things worked back then. So,
but I find it really charming because I'm not in any of the family scenes, so I get to sit and watch them a lot. It's really charming to watch them do all that pumping of the water and grinding of the coffee. I'm just fascinated by those scenes every time I get to sit and watch them.
Now, the character of Simon Stimson, who you play, David, is sort of the omens of what's to come in the future sometimes. He, like you said, you're outside of the family, and you're really the only character in the play who is outside of the family who is commonly listed as a main character. Tell us a little bit about that.
I play the organist at the church, and I have a secret or perhaps not so secret drinking problem that everyone knows about. I just don't realize that people know about it. I always thought he was like the really dark character in the show. He certainly is a troubled soul, I suppose. But and yes, Thornton Wilder used Simon as sort of like his dark side into the soul of the show.
And when you came in, did you think of the character as simply being a drunk, or did you realize what depth there was to the character?
I didn't want to play him like Otis on Annie Griffith. I didn't want to be just the stumbling drunk. I was really hoping to try to find that it's not so much that he's a drunk, but that he does have some pretty serious problems in the background that are causing him to be the way he is.
And of course, everybody comes up with different reasons for his alcoholism. Some say it's, he's a creative spirit trapped in a small town. Some say it's past family tragedy. Have you made any discoveries yourself regarding that?
Oh, well, I think I have. I think I have decided that certain things about Simon's backgrounds, that perhaps he did come from an abusive childhood, that he doesn't fit in with the town, that although people accept him, he does not fit in with everyone else.
Now, of course, small town life is the main theme of this particular play. And one of the great things about working in a theater where it's a lot of people who come from the same community, and not only geographically, but also the theater community, you're close with a lot of people. There's some people you don't know particularly well, just like in a small town. Has this been something that has lent itself to helping with creating the play, or is it something that has made no difference at all?
I think it has definitely come a lot. I mean, just between Angela and myself sitting here, I mean, we've known each other for 20 years now.
Oh, more than that.
Actually met doing a young people's theater that was created by Tim Perina, who is at the helm of the Covedale. So for me, actually, it feels like I'm coming home to a lot of these people.
And me as well. I had to take a 17-year hiatus from theater. So coming back and working with Cincinnati Landmark Productions is just absolutely fantastic. It's quite humorous. I see people that I'm now working with that I worked with 25 years ago. And the newer generation of Cincinnati Landmark is floored that I know all these bigwigs like Tim Perino and Greg Procaccino and people like that.
And of course, the Covedale, located over in Westwood, is a very popular theater on the West Side. You're bringing a lot of people who primarily go to the Covedale for shows and nowhere else. So you're getting people who are coming from also very tight-knit communities on the West Side. Now, this is something that has always come up when I've done Covedale interviews. The Covedale is relatively new space. It's been around for about 5 years, and it's constantly expanding in terms of its physical space and in terms of what they do. Is this the first time you've worked at Covedale?
I directed for them during their first season, which was, I guess, about 5 years ago now, 6 years ago. But this is my first time back since then. So I actually kind of have the pleasure of being with them when they kicked off and then kind of seeing where they are 6 years later.
Have you seen very many changes?
Oh, yes. I mean, they are really working hard to make that a quality theater out there. And I'm really, really impressed with the work they've done.
And Angela, is this one of your first shows since the hiatus?
It is. It is. Yes.
And have you enjoyed working there?
Oh, absolutely. Wonderful.
Now, recently also it was announced that they have brought on Karen Young, the owner of the former Sensei Costume Company,
yes,
as the resident costumer for
yes.
the theater, which is, I'm sure, very exciting because she's done a lot there and she's worked with a lot of people, I believe, with you, David, a couple of times.
Yes, she certainly knows her stuff, and we were thrilled that she came aboard to do our town and to come aboard to the Covedale to be their resident costumer.
When rehearsing a show like this, of course, you know, you have to worry about the relationships within the family and within the community and all. And several people may play multiple characters. Do you find yourself getting confused about who's who sometimes, or are you pretty focused on what each person is representing for you?
I believe we're pretty focused. Everybody's just themselves. So there's not much doubling of the roles in our show this time.
And I mean, I think that our director, Mike, has done a really good job of walking us through the process of all the scenes and what we need to know and what the background is and everything. And that helps us keep focus on what you need to know.
Now, of course, the scene that you two have together is the choir rehearsal. And usually it's played with the organist miming, playing the organ, and organ music playing, and the women singing. I'm assuming that's the arrangement for this particular production.
Yes.
Angela, have you and the ladies have many chorus rehearsals to get this pulled together, or did the director just say, just sing it like ladies who would be singing, you know, and not necessarily worry about the actual practice of the practice?
We actually just kind of throw it together, and it's quite funny because my background, I'm a graduate of College Conservatory of Music with an opera performance degree. So when my husband, Dr. Gibbs, refers to me as singing like a cow, it's quite difficult, but we do muddle through, and it's a good scene.
Yes, I think anyone who perhaps has sung in any church choir will certainly appreciate our rendition of a typical church choir.
Yes.
And that's a good point. Do you find yourself recognizing people from your own life in this particular story?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Without a doubt. I can point to several characters, including a few Simons I've run across in my life that I can pull from.
So, after a hiatus of 17 years, do you plan on doing productions beyond this, Angela?
Yes, actually. I do have a role in the next production for the Covedale, the It's a Wonderful Life. I play the role of Ma Bailey. So, very much looking forward to that.
And anything on your plate coming up after this production?
Actually, my plate is clean, so if anyone would like to offer me a job, please let me know.
Directing or acting.
Absolutely.
Well, that's Our Town playing at the Covedale Center for Performing Arts, November 6th through the 23rd. I'd like to thank this evening's guests, Angela Alexander Nally. Thank you, Angela.
Thanks, Jim.
And David Radke. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
For more information on Our Town at the Covedale, be sure to visit our website at wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Jim Stump.
Support for WVXU comes from the Business Courier, celebrating the region's best places to work at the annual awards celebration and luncheon on November 6th. A list of finalists, more information, and registration are available at cincinnati.bizjournals.com or at 513-621-6665.
Barbara Gray sits down with a local photographer to talk about his latest book.
I'm talking with Robin Victor Goetz tonight about a beautiful book for which he did the photography. It is entitled Room at the Table. Welcome to Around Cincinnati, Robin.
Thank you very much.
Room at the Table is such a welcoming title and sort of opens the door to the Southern hospitality that it actually represents. This book would certainly pass the aesthetic test for a coffee table book, but it's much more than that. And a lot of that is due to your wonderful photographs. So tell us all that this book includes and what your part in it is and where the idea came from.
Well, the original idea came from the Bed and Breakfast Association of Kentucky. They had an idea for several years now that they wanted to put together a cookbook of the popular recipes that these different bed and breakfasts have. And the idea was to take 30 of the premier bed and breakfasts in Kentucky, get them all together in one book with their recipes that they are well known for, and create a cookbook. Mm. The whole book itself is a collaboration between 31 authors. There's not one single author. The 30 authors would be the 30 different bed and breakfasts, and then, of course, myself being the photographer.
Well, one of the wonderful things is that this is, along with these wonderful recipes and literally mouth-watering photos that you took, this is also a history book and a travel book. So it's certainly an enjoyable and enlightening read, but it is beautiful. And I'm wondering, because you were photographing buildings as well as animals in some circumstances and food, is there a difference between photographing food and photographing a building, or is it just lighting and your talent?
My background is so diversified in photography. I started out as a wedding photographer, although I don't do weddings anymore. And I work for a wedding photographer, David Zeiser, who is phenomenal when it comes to wedding photography. And his angles and the way he saw things were so unique to me that it had such an impact that carried forward into my other photography. So as my years progressed, I found other things that I enjoyed doing besides portraiture. And that included everything from animals to children, which is all considered portraiture. But then I kind of migrated into commercial photography. So as far as the different, the animals and the buildings and the food, all subjects, the way I look at them, are the same. So depending upon how they are lit, it's going to bring out their natural beauty. So you just have to decide what type of lighting, the background, the environment, that all has everything to do with looking at the photograph and, for example, food and saying, gosh, I just want to eat that page.
I am very curious to know if you got to stay over at some of these wonderful places, and did you get to test the food?
I did. I got to stay in several of these bed and breakfasts, and I have to tell you, I've only been in a couple prior to this book, and my wife and I are now just very much into bed and breakfasts. We've met a lot of friends along the way. As far as tasting the food, yes. I sampled pretty much everything, but after a while, you become so involved in what you're doing as far as from my aspect, you know, the photography, that I no longer looked at it as something to eat. Everything in this cookbook, to be honest, are great Sunday breakfast, brunch things when you have family over for the holidays or special occasions.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's such a wide variety of recipes. For instance, there's a shrimp and lobster bisque. There's honey bourbon pork tenderloin. Martha Washington's excellent cake. There's shaker lemon pie, mint juleps, of course. But I must tell you, the one that intrigued me the most, and I'm interested to know if you tasted this, is the old geezer cake. and it has rhubarb in it, of all things.
No, I did not taste that. The other cookbook committee ladies, there were five of them, they all sampled it. And, of course, every one of the recipes had to pass their tasting prior to even being accepted into the cookbook. So they actually took the recipes, made them, and then said, yes, we would like to include this into the book.
Well, going back to the history part of this, there's certainly a history that goes with these buildings that house the bed and breakfast. But it was also interesting to learn that the hot brown was originated in Kentucky and bib lettuce was developed there. So some historical food notes come up in here also. Would you tell us a little bit about the variety of buildings that are included in these bed and breakfasts?
Well, most of the buildings are historical in nature. Several of them are reconstruction. There is a bed and breakfast out in Burlington, Kentucky, Willis Graves Bed and Breakfast, where they have a log cabin that actually came from the airport property that they had purchased from the airport board. And they had a gentleman reconstruct this cabin, although it's a bit larger than what it originally was, had him reconstruct this into what the original cabin might have looked like out of the original logs and everything. The rest of a lot of the bed and breakfasts have such historical significance to them. One down in Lebanon, Kentucky, Myrtle Dine, the story goes that Captain John Hunt Morgan rode his horse up the steps in the house to the balcony and remained on top of his horse and gave a rallying cry to his troops down in the front yard. Today, the shoe print is still in the wooden stairs as you're going up the steps from him making his charge up. So those types of things to me are the most interesting aspects about the bed and breakfast because I'm a big history buff.
Yes,
to begin with.
Little nuggets of information. Well, I was interested also that they included old mansions, taverns, church, I think, in one case. You came upon some interesting animals along the way too.
Since I love photographing a wide variety of things, it was never something that they said, hey, while we're doing this, can you get photographs of the animal? It's just something that I did along the way. Being an animal lover myself, I just would see something, an animal, for example, a cat sitting in some grass. And it was just the way it was looking at me, said something, and I took the shot. Well, at the end, we had nearly 7,000 photographs to edit through. And there was a reoccurring pattern of several things. One was animals. The other one was porches. And I don't know where that came from, but I guess maybe because of my thinking that when you think of Kentucky, you think of a veranda or something like that. So in the end, when we went through and edited through these, we found several things that weren't planned that they decided to include into the book to help tell the story.
Like themes, yes.
Exactly.
Yes. So I think we've given people an idea of the variety in this book. And again, it is, like its title, very welcoming and certainly something to take along on any trips to Kentucky that you're planning. I want to thank Robin Victor Goetz for visiting with us tonight. He was the photographer for Room at the Table. You'll find more about this at WVXU.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Barbara Gray.
Support comes from Pedigree Interiors, a nonprofit consignment shop offering fine furniture and decorative accessories from names like Henriden, Drexel, Pottery Barn, Thomasville, and more. Proceeds benefit the United Coalition for Animals Spay-Neuter Clinic to reduce pet overpopulation. Pedigree Interiors in Montgomery Square, 1/2 mile north of downtown Montgomery.
This year marks the 10th anniversary of Ricky Nye's Blues and Boogie Piano Summit. Boogie Woogie fans will be making their annual trek to the Southgate House in Newport, Kentucky on Saturday, November 8th. Here's a sample of music from an earlier Blues and Boogie Piano Summit featuring Ricky Nye.
yourselves a hand. Thank you very much.
Creole Boogie by Ricky Nye, who will be one of the featured performers at the 10th Anniversary Blues and Boogie Piano Summit at the Southgate House in Newport on November 8th. For more details, check our website at wvxu.org.
Support comes from the Neuroscience Institute, now operating under its new name, University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute at University Hospital. UCNI offers comprehensive patient care for brain tumors, epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, stroke, voice and swallowing disorders, and more. Information at 866-941-8264 or tnicincinnati.com. Support comes from the Arthritis Foundation. For those who have been diagnosed with arthritis, the Arthritis Foundation, in collaboration with Bethesda North and Good Samaritan Hospitals, provides resources and tools for living well with arthritis. To learn more, 513-271-4545 or at arthritis.org. Take control. We can help.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 2nd of November, 2008. It's the birthday of the first great American frontier hero, Daniel Boone, 1734, born near Reading, Pennsylvania. Family moved to North Carolina, where Daniel loved to hunt in the forest, educated himself on his hunting trips, taking books with him, took long hunting and exploring expeditions, crossing the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky. Even in his lifetime, Daniel Boone was a figure of legend, captured by Indians, lived with them before he escaped, and that made a great story back home. Daniel Boone never said much, and so biographies of him began to appear, in which his biographers had free rein to invent long speeches for him, have him wrestling with bears or swinging away from Indians on vines. Even Lord Byron wrote about him in his epic poem, Don Juan, of the great names which in our faces stare, the General Boone, backwoodsman of Kentucky, was happiest amongst mortals anywhere. For killing nothing but a bear or buck, he enjoyed the lonely, vigorous, harmless days of his old age in wilds of deepest maze. It was on this day, 1960, Penguin Books was found not guilty of obscenity by a jury in a landmark trial in London over the book Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence, about a young woman whose husband is paralyzed and impotent and who has an affair with her gamekeeper. The book, published privately in 1928, banned because of explicit sex scenes. But in 1959, Britain passed a new law which made it possible for publishers to defend against charges of obscenity if they could prove that a book had literary merit. And so the next year, Penguin Books published a new edition of Lady Chatterley's Lover, and they were brought to trial immediately. It was a big trial in London. The defense called a series of prominent writers and literary critics, including E.M. Forster. The case lasted 5 days, and it took the jury just 3 hours to reach a not guilty verdict. Penguin came out with 200,000 copies, and they sold out on the first day of publication. The second edition of the book, published the next year, was dedicated to the jury who had made publication possible. And it's the birthday of Marie Antoinette, born in Vienna in 1755, the daughter of the Empress Maria Theresa and the Emperor Francis I. She was married off to the future King of France, Louis XVI, to preserve the alliance between Austria and France. The French Revolution began in 1789. The people stormed the Bastille. Louis XVI and his wife were stripped of power, put on trial, and both sentenced to death. Marie Antoinette was taken to the guillotine in October 1793. Here's a poem for today, a poem by W.S. Merwin, entitled To a Leaf Falling in Winter. At sundown, when a day's words have gathered at the feet of the trees, lining up in silence to enter the long corridors of the roots into which they pass one by one, thinking that they remember the place as they feel themselves climbing away from their only sound, while they are being forgotten by their bright circumstances. They rise through all of the rings, listening again afterward as they listened once, and they come to where the leaves used to live during their lives, but have gone now, and they too take the next step beyond the reach of meaning. A poem by W.S. Merwin, To a Leaf Falling in Winter, from Present Company, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can find thousands of classic and contemporary poems by hundreds of poets online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Thomas Schweitzker and Katrina Ciccola. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from the Mill Valley Office Campus, set among 7 wooded acres at the downtown gateway to Eden Park. Mill Valley, offering 5,000 to 15,000 square foot office environments along the close-in I-71 corridor. Mill Valley is represented by John Schenck at Grubb & Ellis, 513-721-4200.
Support comes from Community Shares of Greater Cincinnati, a partnership of 27 local nonprofits working for affordable housing, access to health care, a sustainable environment, and human rights for all in Greater Cincinnati. You can learn more at cintyshares.org or 475-0475. Community Shares, building social and economic equity and a healthy environment.
This has been Around Cincinnati. Technical assistance from Kevin Rowinski and Bruce Ellis. Executive producer is Jerry Donnelly. On next week's show, you'll hear about the narcotic farm in Lexington, Kentucky, where famous jazz musicians were treated, and the fellow who trains dogs for Broadway plays drops by. Next Sunday from 7 to 8 on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay.